I'm speaking today with a passionate and multifaceted veteran, pilot, test flight engineer, project manager, real estate developer, runner, and wellness expert, and author of the book Get Out of Your Own Way, A Scientific Approach to Un-effing Your Brain, Fix Your Body, and Unleash Your Power. The book's title actually isn't, I don't think it's effing, I think it's something else, but you know, I don't want to
get... Close enough.
Mm-hmm. Corey, welcome. Before we get right into the book, I want to sort of get a feel for where, given everything that you've done, I mean, your accomplishments, you've done so much. So whose way were you getting out of? Because really, if you take that introduction and people would listen to that and say, so was she getting out of her way before she got into this? Or is she getting out of the way of the person that is this? That's the question I have for you. What's the path that brought you to this, you know, this revelation, this book that shares so much?
Yeah, that's really a great question. And it kind of gets to the crux of how, you know, I was feeling. And I feel like a lot of people feel this way that, you know, you are high functioning, right? I mean, we're all busy professionals and we've done a lot in our careers. And what kept really sort of hitting me over the head was that I feel like I've done a lot, and yet there are things in my life that I can't conquer, you know? I mean, I can't get out of my own way to like maximize my health, you know? I can't get out of my own way to, you know, lose the last 20 pounds or whatever. And I feel like for a lot of us, there's like real health consequences to not being able to get out of our own way. You know, we're diabetes and other lifestyle chronic diseases are just kind of running rampant. And yet we're all so frustrated by it. You know, it's sort of normal, but it's incredibly frustrating. And we spend so much time and energy thinking about it, going to the doctor, just managing ourselves. And even if it's, you know, call it the vanity of it, right? Maybe you're not even seeing the real health consequences yet. You're just spending so much time and mental cycles on this. And yeah, I mean it's exactly what you said. I mean, that we're out there, you know, doing stuff. We're out there being productive people, and yet we still feel like I can't even get some of these basics done, you know? Yeah.
So do you see that? I'm going to use a really strong term here. Do you see that kind of like an imposter syndrome where you're doing all this stuff and you're looking at the person who's doing all this stuff and saying, but that's really not me, because when I'm in my private time, I feel like a bag of dirt. I just can't get it going. And yet when I come out into public, I've got this facade I put on that's powerful and exciting and conversative and has brilliant ideas. But as soon as I get home, I question everything that I've just done. You know, was that a brilliant idea?
100%. 100%. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Imposter syndrome, or our public face, or whatever we want to call it. Yeah. We're out there doing stuff. And yet, if only they really knew, right? If only they really knew that, you know, when I get home, I'm going to like, you know, eat half a gallon of ice cream and a bottle of wine, you know, like it really does feel that way. Yeah.
So I've noticed that the title of your book, Get Out of Your Own Way, number one, it was a song by U2 in 2017. and there's a lot of other books out there with a similar title to them. Is it because, in essence, the vast majority of human beings really are in their own way? They're kind of blocking themselves from their maximum potentials, as it were. Like you say, unleashing your own power, or that kind of thing. Is that something that just resonates? Like, did you notice when you released the book that people just glommed onto it because of that?
Yeah, I mean, I really do think that most of us have kind of a little, you know, we've got this little, you know, fire burning inside of us. You know, maybe it's just tiny getting started, you know, with a little kindling, but there's probably something that you've always thought about or something that you're really interested in. And you know, we just get in our own way of it because we spend, and I think we just, one of the easy targets for getting out of our own way is our health, right? We spend an inordinate amount of time. The health and wellness industry is billions with a B. And so obviously we are, all of us are spending so much time, energy, and stress over it. And it just ends up taking so much, so much time of our day and so much energy that, yeah, we can't get that little fire that we've got going in our gut. We can't like get it going because we just spend all these cycles doing other stuff.
So I take it why in the beginning of your book, you mentioned, you say, if only I knew now what, you know, knew then what I know now, what are some of the key points, I guess I would say, so that we're not, you know, talking for hours because somebody should buy the book if they want to know all the details. What are the key points that you picked up on over the course of time that you really wish you knew, you know, 20, 30 years ago?
Yeah. I mean, I think the biggest one is it's not your fault. Number one, right? It's not your fault. So many of us are going around like, you know, constantly shaming ourselves, feeling bad about what we're doing, you know, feeling that imposter syndrome. And let me just tell you, it's not your fault. Now, you can take responsibility for it, right? You can decide that you want to make changes, but the way that you ended up this way is absolutely not your fault. And so I think just, and that kind of starts the whole process to me. It's like, once you can set down that shame and recognize that it's not your fault, then something magical happens almost immediately, because what happens for most of us is this thing I like to call the shame cycle. So, you know, you're feeling guilty, shame, and all this negative feelings, right? And so you developed over time a way to cope with that feeling, regardless of how it all started. Like, you developed a way to cope with that. And a lot of times it's with alcohol, food, you know, some other dysfunctional habit, right? And so then you engage in that activity, your drug of choice, to try to numb out those feelings. Well, now you've just engaged in this behavior that you don't like about yourself and that you know contributes to your poor health. And so now you feel even more shame and guilt for what you've just done. And what's your automatic response to feeling shame and guilt? Well, you're right back in the cycle. So you go right back into, you know, having that half gallon of ice cream after you get home from work. And so you're just constantly in the shame cycle. So that's my very first, you know, go-to with people is like, let's get out of the shame cycle. There's nothing wrong with you. You are not broken, and this is not your fault. So right. that's the biggest thing. And we can make a ton of progress by just getting out of that shame cycle.
So in technical terms or psychological terms, we're talking about cognitive dissonance, right? Where we've got a mindset that says these are negative things, but in our brain we're kind of going, but yeah, you know, my belief system says this is the way things should be, but I really don't like this. And you're split. You've got a split brain kind of scenario where your beliefs are one way and the realities are different, and you're trying to make excuses for it, right?
That, 100 like, exactly, 100%. We experience that cognitive dissonance over so many things. You know, even after we get out of the shame cycle, we're going to continue to experience that cognitive dissonance. And so, I mean, that's one of my big tenets is like, let's get some awareness around that cognitive dissonance. I mean, people, you know, are always kind of a little not sure that this is like a real phenomena, but to me, some of the most fascinating research about cognitive dissonance and the way that we as humans are automatically programmed to resolve that dissonance. Some fascinating research in the 60s with these split brain patients. So for the most part, the sides of the brain were severed on purpose, right, surgically as a treatment for epilepsy. And so they're able to do some fascinating research where, you know, you can like show an image to one side, you can split the visual field, yep, so that you're showing an image to one side of essentially your brain through your visual cortex. And then, you know, try to get the person to respond to what they're seeing, right? And depending on, you know, which side of the brain it is, sometimes they can verbally respond because that side is responsible for verbal processing. Or maybe they have to draw it, what they saw. And the classic response that really demonstrates the way that we will automatically resolve cognitive dissonance. So they show this patient a happy face. And so he draws a happy face. And so then the researchers asked him, well, why did you draw a happy face? And he says, well, what do you want? A sad face? Like, that doesn't make any sense. You know, not realizing that, well, I had to draw it, right? I had to draw it. I couldn't speak it, right? Which was really what was happening. But his brain makes up a reason why he draws this happy face. It's so fascinating to me. And we do this, you know, we do this all the time. Now, fortunately, you know, our brains are not severed and we can gain this awareness around when we're doing that. But to me, that's another like just classic example of why this is not your fault. Your brain is responding to the environment in the way that it evolved. But we can have some awareness around it and we can see when we're, you know, making stuff up just to like prove ourselves right in the moment.
Well, that sort of speaks to something later in the book where you talk about being, and it's more related to emotions, but I mean, mental processing is also where you talk about journaling and you say, schedule times in the day and just simply write, what are you feeling? What are you thinking about? What's going on in your head to make yourself more aware of your cognitive process, of your emotional processes. And that would sort of speak to the cognitive dissonance aspects in the sense that, why did I make up that excuse? And you write it out. You actually detail, you don't, but I mean, you're suggesting to people to detail out things like that to allow them to process in their head that they're aware of doing that. And it kind of puts them in a place of being observant of their actions, which goes to another quote of yours, which is, we are not our thoughts. And that's a big piece for you, that what goes on in your head isn't what makes you who you are. Although I kind of counter that with, your thoughts are yours, right? You create them. Every individual is unique. There's no two people. It doesn't matter even if they're twins. They've come up in the same context. They've had things that have happened. Even something as small as a spider bit one toe and the other twin didn't have that happen, it will change things their brain, their processing. So everything that goes on in your head, like you say, if you stand back and look at all the noise in your head, you'll get pretty surprised and sometimes horrified of the nonsense that runs. But being aware that it's in there and being aware it is, it's all part of you. It's how you were brought up. It's things that you've seen. It's things that you've imagined. It's all of your imagination. But being aware, it's not what makes you who you are. It is just simply things that your brain is processing and running around on.
Exactly.
That, to me, it's revelation. It's the kind of stuff that people need to do to be aware of this. We do most cognitive dissonance processing subconsciously. We don't do it consciously. We don't sit there oh, I have an excuse for this. No, it's just simply a flip. You get hit with a question or hit with a scenario, you feel a certain way, and your brain immediately goes, oh, and that's why. Without you looking at it going, what? Wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. And then you're journaling to pull yourself back, extract, and become the observer. Watch the process. It's kind of difficult to do that when you're driving a car and you're yelling at the guy who's next to you. Why am I doing it? And you crash.
Right. Yeah.
But when you get home to write that out, it might be a valuable process to engage in.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, this can be quite a daunting task for a lot of people. I mean, you know, even just asking them to journal can be challenging. And so one of the first things that I have people do is, you know, when they're kind of disconnected from their emotions and they're really just, you know, reacting throughout the day, the first thing I like to have people do is that exercise you referred to, is just like set that timer for like every hour. And you don't even have to do a full journal. It's just like jot down what's kind of the first emotion that comes to you and then just start getting that awareness. And then once you're getting kind of comfortable with that, then you can kind of go back and look at that and you can reflect a little bit about, well, I had like 5 hours where I was like feeling anxious or uptight, right, all day. So then like, okay, now let's write what was going on, right, to create that feeling of, you know, anxiousness or uptight or clenched jaw or whatever. And then really start to understand that. Because, like you said, you know, we're not our thoughts. You know, I think Michael Singer was, you know, wrote a great book about this. The fact that you can observe your thoughts, right, means that you aren't them, right? They're happening in your brain. And there's, as you said, tons of reasons why those thoughts are there. Another great book is Liminal Thoughts. And it explains, help us understand a little more about why some of those thoughts are there. And the reason that I think it's important for people to understand this about you're not your thoughts is that sometimes we will double down on negative emotion because of the thought that was created, you know, and we think, oh, we're a horrible person, or like, oh, I had a craving, you know, so I'm obviously never going to get out of this. Like, no, it's just that thoughts are just things, right? They're just, you can observe them. There's nothing wrong with you for having them. We can observe them, we can let them pass, we can try to understand them. There's all kinds of things we can do without just having to immediately react to them.
Exactly. The fact that the only people that really, when they have a thought that they feel is not themselves, those would be clinical psychiatric scenarios of possible schizophrenia, where they hear a voice and it is not something in their head. It is. But for them, there's a chemical dissonance in their brain that allows them to believe this is outside, it's extraneous to themselves. Everybody else,
yep.
Your thoughts are yours. They yep. come from all the context that makes you who you are, but you can stand back and look at thoughts. Thoughts do not make the person makes the thought. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting yep. construct, and I know you mentioned liminalism, and I've researched the heck out of liminalism, so we won't go into that quite yet, because the brain and the emotions are a strong component of your book, but there's also a component of diet, and there's a component of health in general. What I liked about the book, what I liked about the very beginning of the book is you, most books, they talk about health and diet, and they bring up all these different, you know, research and studies and so forth, but they never get to you. So as the reader, you're reading all this stuff and you're taking in information, you're flooded with amounts of information that you go, okay, that sounds good, that sounds right. How does it impact me? And you don't really think about it that way. You start off by saying, go to your freaking doctor and get a blood test. At a minimum, get a blood test so you have baseline study. Here's what I am, here's my health level, here's who I am from a physical standpoint. And I read that and I went, oh, come on. This is what you're supposed to do. This is the key statement for any health and wellness book is, where are you now? Give me a baseline. Yep. And most of them don't do that. They don't start with a baseline. Some of them say, you know, look at yourself and, you know, contemplate and think about where your brain is at. But that's not going to help because you're not a physician. Physician, heal thyself, is probably one of the key statements to any doctor, but it's also to any human being. It's hard to look at yourself objectively and think of what you need to fix. So getting a professional baseline opinion of here's where you stand, now you've got a place to go from. If you're 100% healthy, which your baseline is telling you, you don't really need to change anything other than why you're saying you're not healthy in your head. But everything else, you've got a baseline that says your sugar's up, or your cholesterol's up, or your A1C's got an issue. Those are the things that tell you, okay, there's my places. I put little check marks in a journal and I say, I'm going to work on this. These are the things. And then go through the book and find those key processes that you can run to help with those issues. So I absolutely love that about the book. Yeah.
Thank you for that. I mean, you know, I feel like the other thing that kind of focusing on your blood work does is, there is so much mental noise about our weight. And for sure, you know, being overweight is the predictor for, you know, long-term unhealthy outcomes, right? So I'm not diminishing it. But we also get so wrapped up in our weight and thinking that that's like, you know, the only marker, and there's a whole bunch of like self-value and self-worth that we get into when we're talking about our weight. So I'm like, let's just not even talk about that right now, right? Let's just go get some blood work done. Let's just do that, right? Let's see where we are. Let's see where our cholesterol is. Let's see where those inflammation markers are. Let's see where, your A1C is. And let's start with that. So we can kind of, I feel like people can be more objective about that. They don't have so much baggage associated with that number for, you know, for all the reasons. And so that seems like something that is, it's an objective measure. We don't consider it, you know, that we're a horrible, you know, invaluable person. If that, if, you know, if our cholesterol is high for some reason, we think, you know, we can deal with that. If we're overweight, we just can't even deal with it. We just want to like ignore it. And so, yeah, I am all about it. And I know a lot of people even have, you know, they have hangups about going to their doctor, and you can even go get your blood work. You can order your own blood work in most states. You can go to the lab yourself and it has a readout and it tells you, you know, what, where the range is and if you're higher or not and whatever. Now, after that, if you start, you know, seeing you've got numbers that are way out of whack and stuff, okay, then that maybe is going to be the wake up call for you to like go to the doctor, you know, or if you're like, okay, maybe I can try diet for a little while and see if that's going to, you know, help these numbers and then get yourself worked up to go to the doctor. You know, my point is start dipping your toe in wherever it feels approachable. You know, I think people like build all of this up and they think I'm going to go to the doctor and the doctor's going to shame me and they're going to tell me I need 25 more tests and it's, you know, it's going to be this big deal and they're going to tell me I'm overweight and okay just dial back the anxiety, just go get a little blood work done and then just try to start implementing what you can, you know, and not get all shamey and judgy about it.
Yep, because that falls back to cognitive dissonance. That you can have an excuse. You'll get your blood work back and the doctor says, okay, your A1C is a little up. You might need to change your diet. Yeah, that's just his opinion. Mm-hmm. Maybe, you know, they're wrong because, you know, I don't feel that way. And mm-hmm. you go back to that. So part of the whole structure, although you'll have the facts in front of you, again, we fall back to getting the mind into a place where you're not going through this process. Look at the facts and stop. And then think, okay, what do these facts tell me? This is a little this. This is, there's no big picture. It doesn't change my version of reality quite yet, but I can at least be observant of it. Mm-hmm. There's a technical term that I've done research for other conversations that I've had around neuroplasticity, which is, yes. I think, that technical term for cognitive dissonance repair, kind of, in the sense that you get into a cycle, as you said, of shaming, of you know, you go through the cycle of, oh, I feel bad. Yep. Then you go and do bad things and you go, oh, I feel bad. You're rewarding the negative things that occur, right? You say you're bad, you do bad things, you say you're bad and you say, see, I was right.
Yep,
and
that's right.
You get your mm-hmm. dopamine rush from doing the wrong thing. And yep. neuroplasticity is a process of essentially telling your brain, you know what, I'm not going to take a positive hit from a negative thing. I'm going to start looking at positive things to generate positive responses and dopamine hits for positive stuff. Look at the sun.
Yes.
Bing!
And yes.
That kind of, it's a slow process, I know.
It is, but that is such a great point. You know, one of the things that I, one of the points that I try to make to people is, you got to get in the habit of celebrating these small wins, because that's the way starting to change that emotion around those things is how you're eventually going to get to the big things. You know, I know I was the queen of not doing that. You know, I would think I'd do something, you know, good, something healthy. And instead of rewarding myself, I'd kick myself even more. I would say, well, I should have always been doing that. You know, this is such a small, stupid thing. Why wasn't I always doing that? You know? And so that just doubles down on the negative emotion. You're never going to make the change when there's no reward for the change, right? So even if it's small, even if you ate one more vegetable today than you did yesterday, you have to celebrate that. You have to acknowledge yourself and say, all right, here I am. I'm making some positive steps. I actually, you know, I did a good thing today. I'm, you know, helping myself, you know, make one more positive step in the right direction. And those little rewards, it might feel silly at first. So what? Do it anyway. Like, generate some of that positive momentum for yourself.
Right. Now, one of the things that interested me, you have a love-hate relationship with the words willpower and discipline. Yep. And for me, another one I threw in there is regiment. And I figured with your background in the Air Force, I would assume that regiment also has negative connotations for you. And yet, yep. for a lot of people like myself, I don't see the negative components of that. My willpower is simply my drive that says, keep doing what you're doing because it seems to be doing well. It's that little push. My discipline is the structure to the things that I do. If I start to do it, I will finish to doing it in the right way. I know I'm mainly retentive in the sense that things have a place. Mm-hmm. That's my discipline. And then my regimen is doing it on a regular basis. So if I get up at 6 a.m. and I have an apple, I'll have an apple at 6 a.m. every day. That is my regimen. And there's a brain piece that rewards that. Yeah, you had your apple. Yay.
Yeah.
You had your apple. Yay. But you have a different, and the way you word the things, I can see where the willpower has a negative connotation to it. And it's more of a, don't think of it that way. But when you express it, it's almost like you want to beat it. I don't like that word, smack.
Yeah. I think those words, the problem is that those words have just been weaponized against us so much, you know, that, well, what's wrong with you is that you don't have enough willpower. And that's a lie. That's not true. We all have plenty of willpower. It's just that it comes in small little doses. And for those of us that maybe have made these longer term changes, and probably people would call us disciplined, right? But that's not, we're not doing it out of this exercise of willpower or this exercise of discipline. We're doing it because we've become that kind of person. Those are just high in our value chain, right? So it doesn't really occur to us not to eat the apple at 6 a.m. because that's just who we are now. We don't have to exercise willpower to eat the apple over, you know, the candy that's sitting there or whatever. Mm-hmm. So that's the thing, is that people, they have been beaten over the head so much with, you don't have enough willpower. And so then again, right, that's another excuse to beat themselves up. I just don't have enough willpower. What is wrong with me? Why can't I figure this out? How do these people do it with all this willpower? And it's not, they're not doing it out of willpower. They're doing it out of a fundamental shift in their mindset and becoming the person that, of course, would eat the apple because that's just what I do.
And it's the right thing to do. And it's right for me because we are all individuals. And everybody repeat that. We're all individuals. That's an old joke. But still, the fact that for us, it's not, we don't use the term willpower. We don't use the term discipline. We will on conversation with others that, you know, I'm regimented. I have discipline. But it's not what drives us. It's not the right force that drives us. But it is a term we can use as a component of what we do to explain the fact that we have structure in our life. We have a force mm-hmm. that tells us to do certain things. We just simply do them because in our mind, there's a positive reward at the end of doing these things correctly. There's a positive reward in maintaining structure. There's a positive reward in doing things over and over again the right way. They say insanity is doing something again and again, getting the same results mm-hmm. and expecting different. Yes. But to do things again and again and expecting the results that you get because they're positive and giving yourself the positive reward, that's regimen. That's discipline.
Yes. And yes.
We don't put those labels on it, but it has a positive aspect. And as you say, those terms have been weaponized as abuse, you know, that you don't show discipline. You have no regimen. You're not. Yep. And the cognitive dissonance side of us will take those and say and use that as the explanation, right? I don't have enough willpower. See, ding, and I get an endorphin. Yep. Right? Yeah. I don't have enough discipline. Bling, and there it is. You know, I've proved myself because I'm such a messy desk. I don't have discipline. I don't have regimen. Yay, and there's my endorphin rush. So
Yeah. And we just have such a I think from the outset, because those words have been weaponized, we have just culturally have a negative kind of connotation to those words. I mean, I think in the book I was talking about like the word discipline, you know, and we think about like these harsh environments where people like in the military, particularly in training environments in the military, where it's disciplined, right? Where somebody's being mean to you so that you have to perform a certain task or whatever. And so, yeah, we build up these just not pleasant ideas around what, you know, willpower and discipline are, and forget about like the positive side of that, you know, like the giving yourself a reward for having, you know, executed on whatever, you know, new habit that you're trying to establish.
Exactly. And I mean, that is not to use the word, but you kind of have to in your head use the word, that's part of that neuroplasticity of changing your habits, changing your reward system in a positive way. Takes discipline. It takes mm-hmm. that mind willfulness to say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to keep doing this. And yes, the one thing that you mentioned, we are all human. We do make mistakes. We do have setbacks, but accept them. not abuse yourself because, oh, I had I ate a cookie instead of eating that grape. It's not a bad thing because your body will process it and it goes away. It's not going to suddenly stay with you. You ate the cookie and it stays with you forever. You know, you're 92 years old. Oh, damn it, that cookie's still not the case. It is not the case.
Yeah.
So allowing for mistakes is perfect.
Yeah, exactly. I'm a proponent for use willpower to like work on your brain, to change your mind. Don't use willpower for behavior. Work on willpower for instilling positive emotion. That's what you can use your willpower for. Because trying to use it for, you know, repetitive behavior change, that's a fool's errand. We've all been there. We've all done it. Doesn't work. That's why we're talking about it now, right?
Yes, exactly. So one of the other things, one of the other points is that you talk about emotional influence on your ability to maintain change. An emotion and your brain's capability. So cognitive dissonance is not about really emotion. And neuroplasticity is not about emotion. It is not. But as human beings, and I'm sorry to say, I really liked your allusion towards Data in Star Trek The Next Generation. Well, you talk about you wanted to be him. And if you recall, there was one episode where a little boy loses his parents and he becomes like Data. And Data has to show him the reality of you're also a human. You have to accept your emotions. And one of the funny things that I thought about with Data is we have empathy towards him. How do you have empathy towards something that has no emotion? Because the empathy is a share of emotion. Yeah. It is to extend the emotion that they have within us. Well, there isn't any, supposedly, and yet we have an empathetic response to him. That kind of thing where we're talking about emotions in a human aspect is huge, but you rarely see that in anything. There's no wellness books that talk about the emotional impact. There's no diet books that talk about emotion other than the joy of eating good food. The joy of cooking. Sorry, that one has emotion, but that's different. That's not really a diet book. That's just cooking. So explain emotion and its impact on health and wellness.
Yeah. So emotion drives us to do everything. That is how we evolved. So over the course of, you know, millennia as humans, you know, the subsequent generations of humans, right? We were driven to do the things that contributed to our survival. So each iteration of human, you know, generation was driven toward more and more so toward the thing that was going to contribute to our survival. So let's talk about food for a second, right? In the environment in which humans would have evolved, food was scarce. Calories were hard to come by. The situation we're in now is an anomaly and not even a tiny speck on the whole time frame of human evolution, right? So it's quite unique. Our brains have not caught up to that. So we are the product of winners, right? We are the product of all of these generations of people that were that survived long enough, found enough food to at least survive long enough to procreate. Yep. So that's a good thing, right? That's why we're here. So there's nothing wrong. First of all, there's nothing wrong with you because you want to eat calorie dense food. That is how we survived. So, but the reason that we were driven toward that is because we get a flood of chemicals in our brain when we ate that food, right? When we ate something, when we got food at all, and for certainly when we got food that was more and more calorie dense, you know, when we got an avocado, right, versus like some blueberries or something. Sure. So and what's funny to me is that we acknowledge the role of emotion in almost everything else, you know, in our selection of our partners, in even now people are acknowledging it in work performance. You know, now people have performance coaches and stuff, and people are acknowledging how emotion drives that behavior. But for whatever reason, we want to stick to this, you know, willpower narrative when it comes to our, you know, health, our nutrition, or our, you know, exercise, our overall physical health. But the fact is that we do have emotions. You know, I did spend a long time trying to deny that because I thought, hey, the way to, you know, hack this whole being successful thing is screw emotions. It seems to me that they just get in the way. But the fact is you're not going to do that. that you are not going to contend with 2 million years of human evolution. You're not going to be the anomaly that gets to opt out of emotion. That's not how your brain works. Sorry, that's just a fact. So the sooner we can accept that, and the sooner we can and begin to address how emotions drive all that behavior, the sooner, you know, we will actually implement changes that are effective and help our physical health.
So you brought up a huge point, and now I'm thinking that's an industry. I'm sorry, part of my brain processing is I take anomalous information and I put it together in a way that people would go, I never even thought of that. The emotional food coach. I've never ever thought about my selection of food being emotionally based. And yet you're correct in the sense that they've got in the workplace, you've got your emotional awareness leadership training, you know, where you're understanding the emotional context of your employees and of vendors and all of this sort of thing. And you have that, as you said, in relationships, just relationships in general, it's emotion based. You don't pick a partner based on how much money they make, although you do how much money they make and all the other important aspects. But the emotional component is key, because if there isn't one, then you're kind of saying, well, you're just meeting a friend, you're meeting a partner, but it's not going to be one that you connect by the heart.
Right.
I've never looked at food and never looked at health as being something that's emotionally based. And yet when I read through the book and I'm replaying it in my head, there are components that you speak of that address the concept of there are emotional choices to dieting. There are emotional choices to my body health, because I don't think of myself, you know, if I'm not feeling well, as just not feeling well, not a physical aspect. Oh, I have a sore stomach. I have an emotional component to that. And there's context to that emotion, because, you know, when I was 2.5 years old, I had a sore stomach and they put me in the sick room and I was all by myself and I feel lonely. So I have a sore stomach, and that's all of a sudden I feel lonely. Why am I feeling lonely with a sore stomach? There is a whole psychological emotional component to wellness. There's a psychological emotion component to food. Why don't you like avocados? Well, let's go into the psychological component of why I don't but nobody thinks that way. There is nobody who thinks that way. You could build based on emotions and food. You know, whole foods could suddenly be wholehearted foods.
I mean, I'm obviously, I mean, this is why I wrote this book, because there are these two strong components that are happening. Yes, there you have these you know, physical reactions. You have these compulsions to eat, you know, calorically dense food, and the modern environment is creating, you know, is doubling down on that drive, because we're engineering food to be, you know, hit those dopamine circuits very quickly. So there's that physical reaction component. But then, just as you said, there's this whole emotional component to it. What did happen to me around, you know, how I felt, how my body felt, what happened to me? How was I taught to deal with emotion at all, right? And so I'm very much, and I developed a whole brain, a whole program, brain and body program, for this reason. Like, we need to march down these paths in parallel. Like, we have to, yes, we can start making these slow changes, you know, in our nutrition and notice how that's making us feel. But we can also start to become aware of emotion and those, how we developed some of those emotions, or how we developed some of these underlying, these liminal thoughts around, you know, what we're eating or how we're using food. And to me, if you're not looking at both of those components sort of simultaneously, it's going to be really difficult to, like, you know, pull the through line here to lasting change.
Well, exactly. I mean, one point that you just brought up that triggers a thought in my head, you mentioned the fact that as the ancient humans, you'd eat food, you'd eat something, not blueberries, you got an avocado, and your brain would flood with endorphins saying, that's a thing you need to do. Go get more avocados, because it was that nutrient rich food that made you better. And our brains have not developed beyond that. We still have lizard brain. We still have the animal brain. Yes, we've got a prefrontal cortex, but that's developed, you know, in the last 20, 30, 40,000 years. We got that component that allowed us to make higher level decision making and so forth. But the trigger parts of our brain are still there. And it's very possible that lovely food industry, as you say, processing foods in a way that create that same trigger, and our environment, nicely, is threatening again. Right. But yes. It may be emotionally threatening. It may be, you know, politics is threatening, but there's this threat component in our head.
Yes.
Look at that and we feel, ah, and of course the social media is throwing threats at us left, right, and center about everything under the sun. Being in a threat scenario, your brain, the old part of our brain is saying, okay, I need nutrient-rich food because there's a threat. And if I'm to survive, I need to have more of this kind of food. And you eat a cheesy and it's laced with the stuff that makes your endorphins kick in, and you go, oh my God, I got to eat more cheesies because it'll make me feel better.
Exactly. In the environment that we would have evolved in, you know, there was a number one, you were eating whole natural foods, right? There was never this processing component to it. And also, because the environment was scarce, there was a natural governor on that, right? So even in, you know, the summer when there was more food available just from the natural, you know, cycle, the seasons, there had been a natural governor on it, right? You could only eat so much because there just was only so much there. And for that matter, our bodies would have been preparing for the winter, where we likely would have had to fast for long periods of time. So it was all, you know, it was prepared. Your body and your brain was prepared to endure these cycles, right? And so we didn't have to worry about overconsumption because survival was the key. Now we have the opposite problem. Like, overconsumption is diminishing our survival, but the environment, that situation is so unique. Arguably, it for sure has not been more than 100 years where that has been a threat to us, right? Where the overconsumption has been a threat to us.
Yeah.
I mean, just having stable calories has only been maybe a couple thousand years, right? Depending on what part of the world you're in, maybe you could argue 5,000 years. But still, that's a nothing. That is a blip on this literally 2 million years of how our brain was evolving. Yep. So yeah, there's this natural drive that we all have. And the thing, though, is that I don't want that to sound like that you can't circumvent that. You can, absolutely. You can remove yourself from that craving cycle. You can remove yourself from the environment by just not having that stuff in your house. And also, you just change who you fundamentally are. You make this mindset shift such that that stuff is a threat to me, right? That, you know, those cookies, those chips, those whatever nasty processed, you know, stuff in the drive-through, there's no way I would consume that because it will hurt me, right? I don't have to. In the same way, you know, I use this analogy, like, I don't need like an accountability partner to keep me from drinking bleach, right? In what way, right? That sounds ridiculous, but I don't need that. No. Nobody needs that because we know it hurts us. Yeah. So in the same way, you can make this mindset shift such that you don't even go down that aisle in the grocery store because all that crap is going to hurt you. So yes. Why would I consume it?
But on the same note as well as identifying the things that you are bleach-like, so to speak, there's also the whole idea of shifting your mind from the other direction of, this is not a threat to me. I know in primitive brain, I'm screaming and railing against it, going, oh my, yeah, so I need to eat. It's to look at the world from the perspective of, yeah, it's not really a threat. I am happy. I have a roof over my head. You know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You have the things that you need to have. You're able to keep moving forward. The things that are going on around you are not the things that are going to affect you. They may in some way indirectly. If you talk about the 5,000 or 10,000 years we've been people, there were wars, huge wars that everybody was involved in, and now we're not in that state anymore. The vast majority of people live in comfort, so to speak, and go on with their lives until the end of their lives, and they have this hypothetical threat hanging over them, this sword of Damocles hanging over their heads for the longest period of time, and that makes them, drives them to make choices that are unhealthy for themselves, simply because their instinctive brain is telling them that's a threat. You have to do things that prepare you for that threat. There's no threat. There is, but we can think it down a little. And that's
right.
A choice in the other direction. There's mental choices about the poisons that are out there that we shouldn't have in our body. But there's also the mental threats of the world around us, the extraneous world that makes us feel threatened, that makes us feel like we have to make bad choices. And
yeah. We can try to like de-escalate it, right, in our brain, or we can also find other coping mechanisms for it, you know, and when we start to do that and we give ourselves positive reward for finding those other coping mechanisms, recognizing how we're feeling as we're engaging in that other mechanism, you know, going for a walk or whatever, and realizing, oh, I feel less stress. Oh, I can hear the birds, like all these other enjoyable things. And now we're creating this positive feedback loop instead of, you know, the negative of, I feel so stressed. What do? I need to, you know, eat crappy food.
And then getting yourself in that cognitive dissonance cycle of rewarding the negatives that have happened to you. Yeah, exactly. This is just talking to you after reading, I'm rewording the book in my head in the sense that the focus changes to things that I've never thought of before. So the emotional component of choice and the emotional component of health that just doesn't play for me in the initial read going through it. Emotion plays a role. You know, you have to recognize your emotions, and it sort of generalized to me. And I went, yeah, of course you recognize your emotions. And yes, journaling makes sense that you do that kind of thing for when you have emotional impacts, when you're yelling at your kid and you go, wait, I'm going to pull back. I'm going to think about it first before I go all, you know, red, whoever it was that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also the component related to food. And as you said, looking at the external world, if you do some quick, you know, every day, schedule yourself to write a word, two words about how you feel about what's going on around you as well, so that you are emotionally aware of how you're feeling about extraneous things, as well as your choices of the day, it kind of builds this picture of your emotional states. And then you can become more, I hate the word controlling of it, but it's the awareness and then the response to these immediate emotional triggers that go off in your head simply based on the part of your brain that you have no control over, your animal piece, your lizard piece. They'll fire off triggers that resemble emotion, and it is, it's fight or flight kind of things that evolved as a human being into something more complex. But really, when you look at it, you go, yeah, there's nothing to be, I'm looking at my notes, really nothing to be that afraid of. So I don't really need to go after the cookies and Cheetos and so forth, because I don't feel so bad. Oh, I'm going to have an apple. I'm going to have asparagus tonight. And it's a much better way of sort of gauging your emotional impacts on those two. That is, I feel like I should go walk a circle for a minute and come back. I'm just, my brain is blowing up in that whole component of the emotional piece related to all of those, the two aspects that I've never thought of emotion associated with. I get emotion with brain issues, get emotion with, you know, how I'm responding to myself around, you know, myself, how I see myself, all of that.
Right.
Emotions related to choice, health-wise, related to choice, food-wise. Holy crap. That's, sorry. No, that's new to me. That's like looking at a picture and saying, I've never seen anything like that before. So,
which is great. I mean, I feel like that's kind of the state of most of us, you know, is that so much of just every single moment of our lives is driven by emotion. And the more that we can have the awareness around that, and then, you know, start picking out those things that have been troublesome, right? And then you can start to, okay, where is that coming from? Are there healthier alternatives? How do I make this, you know, how do I double down on the positive? How do I turn this into a positive and keep reiterating that part? But yeah, and just accepting, like, this is the nature of being a human being, and it's just an is. So just, you know, the sooner you can accept that and the sooner you can engage with it, like, the better, the healthier you're going to be.
So we've looked at un-effing your brain, and we've looked at fixing your body components of the book. I want to know about the power component. So what is that piece? Because I understand, I mean, I know what I'm capable of, but in all essence, it's almost reads like there's something inside that we can push forward. And I want, from your words, a more explanative kind of, what are we talking about here? Your own release?
Yeah, I think it's kind of the same, you know, like foundational tenets, right? It's all about this like experimentation, you know, and trying to get some awareness around it. You know, what do I care about? You know, I think that I have this passion for, I don't know, helping kids, right? And so that's great. And again, we were doing in your brain and your body, so often we put so much pressure on ourselves, like, oh, I want to help kids, so I got to go change the world, and I've got to, like, you know, set up this nonprofit, and I got to get, you know, Oprah to donate to it, and blah, blah, blah. Like, no, all you have to just, like, take one little step toward doing that, you know, take the one step, go, you know, volunteer at whatever, like, local, like, Big Brothers, Big Sisters, or something like that. Like, just take whatever you think you have a little bit of passion for, but maybe you're not even sure. Okay, just go try and experiment. Just, like, go do it a little bit, become aware of how that made you feel, what components of it were, you know, felt rewarding or didn't. Maybe that ultimately wasn't, you know, your passion. And so just getting into this kind of experimental mindset and this awareness around it is how you're going to, like, keep building that fire within you. And, you know, every little thing you do, I think the thing that people maybe, the thing that's unappreciated is that every little step you make, you're making an impact already. I mean, just by improving your health, I guarantee you're making a healthy impact on all the people around you, because they see that you're changing. They see that you're doing things a little bit different. Sometimes you're giving them permission to be healthier, right? If you are living in an environment and a culture where, you know, being healthy is kind of stigmatized, or eating healthy food has some kind of stigma to it, but you are making some little changes, you're giving them permission. So just little things, you know, if you go volunteer 1 hour a week, you're changing the people around you without even, like, having this big grandiose vision of, you know, how it is that you want to change the world.
So that's it's kind of an interesting way to look at releasing who you are when you mentioned that it has an impact of people around you. And it's not even subtle. I spoke recently with an individual who is suffering an immense amount of pain and working through that. And I said, pain isn't just something that impacts yourself. It impacts everybody around you because of who you become when dealing with it. And the same is true with when you're changing who you are and you're eliminating negative impulses and negativity within your own life. It impacts everybody around you because it's not that you become somebody new. It's that you become the real who you are.
Yeah.
And right. People around you get to see it, and they kind of get to relax, because probably when you're being not yourself, they can feel something's off, and they have to kind of feel like they're on eggshells because they're not sure what's going to maybe set you off or what's going to make you be more different than you currently are. But being authentic, being you, you kind of relax and you get to be, hi, I'm just me, and I'm happy with who I am, and I'm actually feeling positive, allows them to relax and be happy. Exactly. And be positive and be kind of comfortable around you, which then that extraneously links to other people around them. And it's kind of like that give back scenario where, but you're not giving anything exactly other than of yourself. You're simply being
exactly
phenomenal. Yeah. Absolutely exactly. Phenomenal.
Exactly.
So I have to ask, what's new? What's next? What's coming up? Because this book really doing well. I want to know what's coming from that afterwards. Have you got a new path? Have you got a new direction? Are you writing a new book? Is there something coming out soon in the future? Are we allowed to talk about it?
Yes. Probably another book. I mean, I'm just sort of in the thought gathering stage there. I have tons of notes about a potential new book. You know, out of this book, I created a whole program to try to help people conquer those first two steps of brain and body.
Right.
So, you know, really trying to move that forward. And then, you know, I think the next step out of that is creating some structure around the power component, you know, just what we were talking about, like how to create community and give people a little structure so that they can start to experiment with how they unleash their power. So I think that's also a next step for me. But yes, there's and just, you know, having written a book at all, you know, that was such a huge learning curve. And so just gathering all the lessons out of that has been some effort in itself. But yeah, there's more to come. I'm not done yet, but we'll see how that manifests itself.
So was the first book very cathartic for you? Because I know it's very personal. Reading through it, there's a lot of you in the book. It's almost like you kind of piece through when you're reading and you go, that's you, that's you. I can sort of put it out there and put paragraphs together and say, okay, that's Corey, that's Corey, that's Corey, that's Corey.
Yep.
Did you find that it sort of helped you push things external to yourself so that you weren't like holding them inside going, there's more of this, and putting them out there kind of helped you with it? I know psychologically people, psychiatrists will say, make your thoughts extraneous. So draw them, write them, push them outside of yourself, and then review them. And you look at them and you go, yeah, it actually wasn't as bad as I've just written. It wasn't as horrible as this. And it allows you to process it. So did that happen for you? Did you go through that process?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, kind of my personal stories for sure are, as you say, there's something to you getting them outside of yourself. But I think maybe not in the way that people often think. When you start to express yourself in that way, it's not just a releasing, which, you know, there's something to that. That's great. But also you almost create, it starts to make sense to you. You create this narrative thread. And so things that seemed like, why did I do that? I didn't understand that. When you have to express them, you start to understand it, right? And the more you express it, the more you begin to understand your own journey, your own life, who you are, right? So there's sure a fair amount of that. But also, I think it was helpful to me in that I had done so much research and tried to understand, you know, all of these elements of nutrition, health in general, and psychology. And so for me to get it out and, you know, to create that, the logical steps was also incredibly helpful to just like, okay, I think I have a lot of ideas here. I think I, you know, am seeing things a bit uniquely. Let me try to get this out and to explain it in that way, you know? So yeah, I think on both sides of that coin, for sure, it was helpful to me.
Oh, fantastic. And I'm sure when people are reading through it, they'll take it in that vein. When they read the book, they will take it in the vein of they'll see your story. They'll personalize it because everybody, when they read something about somebody else, they take it internal and they go, yeah, I've been through that. Only my experience was slightly different, but I see what you've done and I could probably follow the same path.
Yep.
For me, you're one of the things you should probably go in a direction of is that emotional choice option for health, emotional choice for nutrient, for food, given the fact that it is so unique that people don't think about the emotional impact of health. They don't talk about it. I mean, there is a whole lot of conversation around how certain communities, certain groups view health industry as something to be avoided because that's not the way we do things. You know, we go other places to get our mental health issues dealt with. We go other places to get our medical things dealt with. You know, like I've got a guy down the street that'll give me pills for things that I need. So that's all I need. I don't need to go see some professional who'll pat me on the butt and tell me everything's fine. I don't need that. But having a focused conversation around where's that coming from? Where's that emotional state coming from? And it's probably context related from your upbringing or whoever is reading it, they'll look at it and go, yeah, and that makes sense. And actually, this makes sense as well. From an emotional standpoint, I get that and I feel that. And that's the thing you want to have people do is how they feel about food, how they feel about health, not how they feel, but how they feel about it.
Right. Yeah. And it's such a, it's such a never-ending loop, right? So how we feel about, you know, what we eat, and then actually what we eat contributes to how we feel. I mean, there's research that shows that diet's actually more effective for depression than, you know, the leading prescription medication. So absolutely, yes, there's this just never-ending cycle of what could be a downward cycle, right? If it's in the wrong direction. But yeah, great point. Yeah.
Yeah, I like how you said that, how you feel about how you eat and then how that makes you feel. But then you could extraneous that by saying how you feel about how you feel and then how you feel about what you're eating make you feel what you feel and how you feel about that. A little complex, but it actually makes sense when you think about how those choices are made, why you make those choices. really think that's a topic that needs, I mean, I could sit and probably talk with you about it for the next, you know, hour, 2 hours, because like I said, that for me is revelation. It brings in all of these context pieces that I've done. I do research as well. And that's when you start realizing some of the stuff that you've been thinking about reading about actually relates to stuff that you've not thought about, right? So all of that emotional awareness, all of that things like neuroplasticity relates to the mind, but it also relates to choice. It relates to how we live our life, how the emotional impact of things. And nobody talks about it. And it needs to be brought into light, and it needs to be looked at in more detail to see where the actual reality is. I mean, I doubt there's very much research being done on emotional choice of food. And yet there should be, because it is. It's major. We're human beings. We're not we're not data. We don't pick, food based on the nutrient level of this food will be good to sustain me for the next 25 minutes. Nobody picks food that way.
Exactly.
So it's good to know that you are moving forward with this, because I'm going to keep an eye on you. I'm going to keep an eye on what you're doing, because you opened my brain up to all these ideas. I want to see you going in directions that keep me interested and elevated in my head. Apart from that, the information that I have that I gleaned while researching you, absolutely phenomenal. I love some of the stuff that I've been looking at. We didn't touch on the liminalism, which I really wanted to get into as well. I've done research on that, and there is some interesting components to liminalism, from its original states to its processing in the psychological world, psychiatry. They're using that as a new methodology. It's Jungian, if you're a person that pronounces it Jungian. And that is in itself another entirely different discussion, although it has impacts here in your book. You mention it. It's talked about in different aspects, but probably something that needs a lot more focus. Absolutely enjoyed this conversation, Corey. It's been one of my favorite interviews, I have to say. Thank you so much for being here. Our listeners are going to enjoy this, and I recommend that they buy your book. I recommend that they go out and they get your book online. I know it's on Amazon. Where else can they find it?
Amazon.
Amazon is where they can get it. Go to Amazon, look for Get Out of Your Own Way, A Scientific Approach to Un-effing Your Brain, Fix Your Body, and Unleash Your Power. It's worth the read. Absolutely worth the read. I thank you so much, Corey, for being here. And I'm looking forward to what's coming up next.
Thank you so much. This is great.